Welcome back to Clown Cast. So, I have a question for you.
Hit me.
If you could walk into a room that transformed into whatever you needed most, like whatever you were craving on a deep psychological level, what would it look like?
Of a room with a really good couch and zero notifications. Maybe a fridge that never runs out of cheese.
Okay, solid answer. Now here's the thing. There is a real place on Earth that does basically that, not with magic walls, but with mountains, trains, and cowbells. And 42 million people walked into it last year.
You're talking about Switzerland.
I'm talking about Switzerland. 42.8 million overnight stays in 2025, highest in 50 years. And here's what's wild. When you look at who's going and why, every single culture is visiting a completely different country. They're all standing on the same Alps, riding the same trains, but they are having fundamentally different experiences. Like, not a little different, radically different.
So it's not just, oh, pretty mountains, nice chocolate.
No, for some people it's a Bollywood love story, for others it's a luxury shopping expedition, for others it's literally a climate evacuation, and for some people it's just a backyard but cleaner. Same coordinates on a map, completely different destinations depending on who walks in.
That's the room of requirement.
That's exactly the room of requirement from Harry Potter. You walk past that stretch of wall on the seventh floor, and the room manifests as whatever you need most. Need a place to practice spells? Training room? Need to hide something? Vault? Need a bathroom? Dumbledore famously found one full of chamber pots. The room reads you and configures itself.
And you're saying Switzerland is doing that, not magically, but functionally.
Functionally, yes. Let's start with India. Over 300,000 Indian tourists visit Switzerland every year, and a huge reason why traces back to a single Bollywood film from 1995, Dilwale Dulhania Le Jayenge, DDLJ. It's one of the longest-running films in Indian cinema history, and it was shot in the Swiss Alps. Green meadows, snow-capped peaks, two lovers running through fields. That movie imprinted Switzerland onto an entire generation's idea of romance.
One movie did that.
One movie. The director, Yash Chopra, became so associated with Switzerland that the town of Interlaken, remember Interlaken from a few episodes back?
The Renaming Spell episode, the monastery town that rebranded itself.
Exactly, that same town gave Yash Chopra the title Ambassador of Interlaken. There's a bronze statue of him there. Hotels in Interlaken have Bollywood posters in their lobbies. They train dedicated DDLJ concierges to walk Indian honeymooners to the exact filming locations. Swiss trains play Hindi soundtracks on what they literally call the Bollywood routes.
Hold on, Swiss trains playing Hindi music through the Alps.
Through the Alps, and souvenir shops sell DDLJ branded cowbells. So when an Indian family walks into Switzerland, the room of requirement shows them a cinematic dreamscape. The meadows they've been watching since childhood, tied to narratives about love, family approval, aspiration. That's what Switzerland becomes for them.
That's beautiful, honestly. But I'm guessing not everyone's hearing Hindi on the train.
No, completely different room for Chinese tourists. China's been one of the fastest growing source markets. And here's the stat that tells you everything. 50% of Chinese tourist budgets in Switzerland go to shopping. Swiss watches, luxury brands, they're seeking wooden chalets, which have no equivalent in Chinese architecture. Artisan cheese, which isn't really part of Chinese food culture. Clean alpine air as a contrast to urban pollution. Switzerland equals safety plus quality plus prestige. It maps perfectly onto Chinese aspirational culture.
So for Indian tourists, Switzerland is a love story. For Chinese tourists, it's a luxury showroom.
Some mountains, different room. And then there's the Gulf States, UAE, Saudi Arabia. They each account for about 35% of all Gulf Cooperation Council tourism to Switzerland. And their reason is the most visceral of all. They're escaping 50 degrees Celsius summers for 25 degree alpine air. It's a thermal migration, a climate refugee luxury retreat.
They're literally fleeing the heat.
Literally, and Swiss hotels have adapted. Arabic speaking staff, halal dining, prayer mats and rooms. Interlaken has been called the new Swiss Mecca for rich Muslim tourists. The Gulf states are building incredible things at home, artificial islands, endless ski slopes. But they can't manufacture centuries-old pastoral beauty. Switzerland offers what money can build everywhere else, but can't replicate.
So the room of requirement for Gulf tourists is basically air conditioning with a view and 1,000 years of history.
With cultural accommodation baked in. And then you've got Japan. Japanese tourists are drawn to precision, craftsmanship, order. Values Japan and Switzerland share deeply. They focus on culinary tourism, wellness, doing things correctly, the right train, the right viewing platform, the right season for each experience. There's a Japanese concept, Monozukiri, which is this deep pride in the art of making things well. Swiss watchmaking, Swiss chocolate, Swiss trains running on time. It resonates on a frequency that's almost spiritual for Japanese visitors.
Okay, so India sees romance, China sees prestige, the Gulf sees escape, Japan sees a kindred spirit and craftsmanship. What about the biggest group?
Germans, 1.7 million visitors a year, the single largest source country. And for Germans, it's kind of the funniest one. Switzerland is basically their backyard but with better maintenance. Same Alps, different currency, slightly different culture. Everything just a little more polished. Close enough for a weekend trip. Foreign enough to feel like travel. Fun fact. The word Wanderlust is German. The culture that sends the most tourists to Switzerland literally invented the word for the urge to travel.
They invented the feeling, and then they found the closest place to scratch it.
And Americans, about 1.46 million visitors, tend to pack Switzerland into broader European itineraries. The greatest hits tar. Matterhorn. Jungfrau. Instagram shot. Check. Next country. Strong dollar makes luxury accessible. The infrastructure makes it frictionless.
So everyone's walking into the same room of requirement, and the room is going, you need romance. You need prestige. You need cold air. You need precision. You need a weekend escape. You need content for your grid. And delivering every time.
Every time. But here's where I want to go deeper. Because the room of requirement metaphor explains the what. I want to talk about the why. And for that, I need a different metaphor entirely.
Ooh, okay, hit me.
Songlines, from Aboriginal Australian Dreamtime. This is one of the oldest knowledge systems on Earth. Tens of thousands of years old. In Aboriginal culture, the land was sung into existence by ancestral beings during the dreaming. And the paths those beings walked became songlines. Invisible routes across the landscape, where every rock, river, and ridge is a verse in a song. Different peoples walk different songlines through the exact same physical terrain. And each songline encodes completely different stories, laws, and meanings.
So the land is the same, but the song you're singing as you walk through it determines what you see.
Exactly, and that's what's happening in Switzerland. Indian tourists are walking a Bollywood songline. Their path goes from the Interlaken Meadows to the Jungfrau viewpoint to the exact bench where Shah Rukh Khan sat. German tourists are walking a hiking songline. Their path goes ridge to ridge, hut to hut, following trail markers. Gulf Arab tourists are walking a luxury songline. Five-star hotel to designer boutique to lakeside terrace. Chinese tourists are walking a prestige songline. Watchmaker's workshop to chocolate factory to wooden chalet photo op. All of them crossing the same mountains. None of them on the same path.
That's kind of profound, actually. Because it means the landscape isn't neutral. It's activated differently by whoever's walking through it.
And this isn't new. This is a pattern that goes back centuries. In the 1700s, Switzerland was a waypoint on the Grand Tour, this aristocratic rite of passage where young European elites would cross the continent. And back then, there were no coach roads through the Alps. You know what they did? They hired teams of men to literally disassemble their carriages and carry them over mountain passes on muleback.
I'm sorry, they took apart their carriage and put it on mules.
Piece by piece, over the mountains. Because the songline of the 18th century aristocrat demanded they cross the Alps as a display of cultural sophistication. The mountains were an obstacle to be conquered, not a destination. Then the romantic poets showed up, Byron, Aeschylus, and they sang a completely different song. They looked at those same terrifying peaks and saw the sublime. Mary Shelley wrote Frankenstein during a rainy summer at Lake Geneva in 1816, arguably the first science fiction novel, born from tourism.
Tourism invented science fiction. I love that sentence.
Then British mountaineers came, and their song line was conquest, summit after summit, founding the Swiss Alpine Club. Then railways arrived, and suddenly the middle class could reach Interlaken, and their song line was democratized wonder. Same mountains through every ear, but the song changes with every generation, every culture, every set of eyes.
Okay, so the room of requirement explains why everyone's experience is different, and the songlines explain why they are literally walking different paths through the same place. But I keep coming back to this question. Is anyone actually seeing Switzerland, or is everyone just seeing themselves?
And that brings us to the Palantir.
Oh, here we go. Lord of the Rings.
the Palantiri, the Seeing Stones, seven of them, made by the elves, scattered across Middle-earth. Anyone can look into one, and they'll see real things. The Palantir doesn't lie. But here's the crucial detail that people forget. What you see depends on who you are. The stone shows you truth, but it shows you selective truth, filtered through your strength of will, your desires, your fears. Denethor looked into one and saw the armies of Mordor, real armies, but without the context of hope. It drove him to despair. Sauron looked and saw what he wanted to dominate. Aragorn looked and saw what he needed to defend.
So Switzerland is a Palantir. Everyone's looking into it and seeing real things. The mountains are real. The chocolate is real. The trains really do run on time. But which real things you notice is completely filtered by who you are.
Yes, and here's where the psychology gets really interesting. There's a researcher named Dasher Keltner at UC Berkeley who studies awe, that specific emotion you feel when you encounter something vast that challenges your existing mental framework. And what he found is that awe experiences, which is exactly what mountain vistas produce, make people feel smaller in a way that paradoxically expands their sense of connection to others. Your sense of self shrinks, and your sense of belonging to something larger grows.
So everyone standing at the top of Jungfraujoch is having the same neurological experience.
Regardless of nationality, the Indian honeymooner, the Chinese luxury traveler, the Gulf family escaping the heat, the German weekend hiker, the American checking off a bucket list, they're all getting the same hit of awe. Same neurochemistry, same brief dissolution of self. They just frame it differently afterward. One calls it romantic, one calls it prestigious, one calls it refreshing, one calls it correct. But the underlying experience, that moment of smallness before something vast, is universal.
So we're more similar than we look.
Way more similar than we look. And, you know, there's research on collectivist versus individualist travel styles. Collectivist cultures like China, India, and the Gulf states tend to favor group travel, family-oriented experiences, risk reduction. Individualist cultures like America and Germany favor solo exploration, novel destinations, autonomy. On the surface, totally different approaches, but the psychological drivers underneath, escape, awe, status, connection, cut across every single culture studied.
The packaging is different. The hunger is the same.
Exactly. And Switzerland has figured this out. Maybe better than anywhere else on Earth. Remember, Thomas Cook's very first holiday tour in 1863 went to Switzerland. This country didn't just attract tourism. It literally invented modern tourism. And it sits at this extraordinary geographic crossroads. Four national languages, German, French, Italian, Romansh, center of Europe. Roman roads crossed here 2,000 years ago. It has always been a convergence point. And the fact that every culture in the world now converges here isn't an accident. It's the continuation of a pattern as old as the roads themselves.
So the room of requirement was always a crossroads. People were always coming through, just singing different songs.
And looking into the same palantir and seeing different truths. But here's the debate-worthy part. When Interlaken plays Hindi soundtracks on its trains, when hotels hire Arabic-speaking staff and stock halal menus, when souvenir shops sell DDLJ kabbalas, is that hospitality? Or is it the room of requirement slowly losing itself? Like, does catering to every culture's projection make the destination less authentically itself?
Oh, that's a real question. Because at some point, if the room is always becoming what visitors want, does the room even have its own identity anymore?
Right. It's the homogenization paradox. And you could argue it both ways. On one hand, Switzerland has adapted to visitors for centuries. The Grand Tour era had its own versions of this. On the other hand, there's a difference between welcoming guests and becoming a theme park version of yourself.
It's like if the room of requirement got so good at showing people what they wanted that it forgot what it looked like when no one was inside.
Beautiful way to put it. And there's a related angle from travel psychology. Researchers have found that passive tourism produces far smaller cognitive benefits than engaged, immersive travel. The 12 countries in 14 days approach literally changes your brain less than staying in one village for a week. There's even neuroplasticity data showing that living abroad improves complex problem solving, but only if you genuinely engage with the unfamiliar. So if every destination pre-adapts to your cultural expectations, you might be losing the actual brain rewiring benefit of travel.
So the best travel is when the room of requirement shows you something you didn't know you needed, not just what you already wanted.
That's the deep cut. Yeah, and there's a trend happening right now called slow tourism, or deep travel. And it's showing up across cultures. Chinese tourists shifting from group tours to bespoke hiking experiences, Indian travelers looking beyond the Bollywood filming locations, American travelers staying in one place instead of hopping countries. It's like cultures worldwide are independently discovering that the best version of the room isn't the one that mirrors you. It's the one that surprises you.
We talked about this a bit in the AI translation episode, right? How breaking language barriers might change how people actually experience places.
Yeah, exactly. If you can suddenly have a real conversation with a Swiss farmer because your phone is translating in real time, your sound line through that landscape changes completely. You're not walking the tourist path anymore. You're walking a local path. And that's a fundamentally different experience of the same mountains.
Okay, so let me try to learn this.
Switzerland is a Palantir, a real place that shows real things, but what you see depends on who you are.
Every culture walks a different songline through the same terrain. The room of requirement configures itself for each visitor.
But underneath all those different projections, the same awe response fires in every human brain.
We are wildly more similar than our travel itineraries suggest.
And the most interesting version of travel might be the one where you stop asking the room to give you what you already want, and start asking it to show you what's actually there.
Man, I'm never going to look the tourism at the same way again.
Every single one is just saying here's what the room will look like for you specifically.
That's literally what destination marketing is. Targeted songlines.
So what's next? Where does this go?
Well, here's something that kept popping up in the research. All these cultures are converging on Switzerland, but they're also all buying things when they get there. Souvenirs, luxury watches, cowbells, chocolate, and the psychology of why humans buy objects and places they're visiting. It's completely irrational and deeply universal. There's this whole field of research into souvenir psychology, and it turns out the objects we buy on trips aren't really about the objects at all. They're anchors for memory, proof of transformation, portable pieces of awe. I think next episode we might need to crack open why humans have this compulsion to bring the room of requirement home with them.
The loot drop episode.
And so ready for that.
The loot drop episode. Alright, that's our show. Thanks for walking the song line with us today.
Don't forget to look into your Palantir responsibly.
We'll see you next time on Clowncast.